The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for, I believe, over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to the October 2021 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month, the Blue Ridge Parkway. We got about three quarters or more through the pictorial last month, and that area is just so beautiful. I'd like to finish it up before we move on to the next article, which is also about the parkway. But we're going to pick up at milepost 409.6. Which is Frying Pan Mountain Lookout Tower. Once the 70-foot-tall steel tower at the top of Frying Pan Mountain helped the U.S. Forest Service look out for wildfires. Today, climbers hike its stairs to glimpse Looking Glass Rock, Cold Mountain, Mount Pisgah, and more. And it's in Canton, or Canton, North Carolina. Now, this is a double-page spread. In the front, we see the fall golden colors of all of the trees down below. And then in the middle of the page, we see some low-lying hills, and in the distance, some, well, the distant low-lying hills, but they're really enclosed in fog and cloud haze and whatever, and it just turns into a whitish-blue sky beyond that. And as you go up, you see various shades of the clouds. They're all horizontal. They're not puffy clouds or whatever. It's a continuous stream all the way across the double spread until you get up high and you get a few open blue patches. On the left, however, fairly near us in the foreground is the old tower, and we see that it has 5 levels, and so you go up a ladder to one level, and then you go walk across it, and you get on the other side, and you walk up in the other direction, and you go back until you've gone up to the next top level, and then it's a little curvature of the stairway comes across. There's a railing there, and you go up to the final level, which is basically a small cottage surrounded by a deck on four sides. So you can walk all the way around it. There's a couple of antennas up on top, and they probably are still functional because it's a nice high place to have something, and they probably relay some signal from here to there over the mountaintops. Beautiful picture. Overleaf, we go to milepost 417, again in Canton. Oh, and it says Looking Glass Rock Overlook. At an elevation of nearly 4,000 feet, Looking Glass Rock cuts a striking figure as it rises up out of Pisgah National Forest. Named for the way sunlight reflects off the sheer granite face when it's wet, like a shiny mirror. Looking Glass is what's known as a Pluton monolith, meaning that it began as a mass of molten rock below the Earth's surface, gradually exposed as the soil above and around it eroded over millions of years. A little subcaption says, if you're gazing out at Looking Glass Rock, if gazing out has you eager to hike it, drive around to the opposite side of the mountain from the Blue Ridge Parkway, and you'll find a trailhead. So on this side that we're looking at it, we just see this sheer surface of the rock here. I bet the rock climbers just love this, looking for little cracks that they can put their hands in. And then at the top, which is top of the rock, which is about three-quarters of the way up, it begins to get into scruffy vegetation. And then it goes up to a summit, which is fully vegetated. To the right, it says Graveyard Fields. This popular area got its name from the mossy tree stump headstones, quote-unquote, that once made it look like a cemetery until a fire swept through in 1925. From the parkway overlook, loop trail heads to waterfalls, high elevation meadows, and fall foliage. It's at milepost 418.8 in Canton. There's a couple here walking across this boardwalk over some area that undoubtedly floods to get back to the main trail. But basically, it's just low-lying hills and vegetation here. At milepost 422.4, we have Devil's Courthouse. From Devil's Courthouse Overlook, you can see the sinister rock face peeking out from the balsam fir trees that helped inspire its name. A steep uphill hike leads to the 5,720-foot peak, where views of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Tennessee unfurl below. So this is just a scene across a little dip in the between two hills here, and you can see some bluish hills in the distance. But going up on the left, all of a sudden there's a break, and there's a big set of boulders there, gigantic rock, and that would be the Devil's Courthouse, where you can see everything from the top. On the right-hand side, it says all but one of the Blue Ridge Parkway's 26 tunnels, including the Devil's Courthouse Tunnel, are located in North Carolina. So this is just the entrance or exit, depending on your point of view. I guess I'd have to say exit because we're inside the tunnel. Somebody took this picture from the center line looking out, and there's a sharp turn in the road. So I hope he was prepared to scurry over to the side really quick if a truck or car came whizzing around the corner. Fall foliage, steep on both sides of the road. Yellow this time. At 451.2, we have Water Rock Knob, and at an elevation of 5,820 feet, the visitor center at Water Rock Knob is the highest on the Blue Ridge Parkway. Its namesake mountain is even taller. 6,292-foot Water Rock Knob is the highest peak in the Platte Balsam Mountains, and the 16th highest peak in the eastern United States. Hike to the summit for a wide-ranging views of the Great Smoky Mountains and Maggie Valley below. Wide view here on a double spread of the road curving in from the right and then just in its distance curving off into the trees on the right-hand side, kind of an S-curve here. It says, at the summit of Water Rock Knob, views unfold in nearly every direction, sweeping across mountain ranges like the Great Balsams, the Great Smokies, and the Craggies, and more. And that's what we see in the distance. It's pretty smoggy, foggy, hazy, whatever. And the individual details here show thunderstruck Ridge Overlook in Maggie Valley, and Soco Falls in Maggie Valley, and Big Witch Overlook also in Cherokee this time. And that brings us to the end of our pictorial. Let's see what this is an ad for. Has it happened or not? It says Winter Wonder Lights, Greensboro Science Center 2021 Glow Wild, November 6th to January 2nd. Join us for a bigger, bolder, and brighter holiday tradition. Special thanks to our media partner, ta-da, Our State Magazine. Ticket information, greensboroscience.org/winterwonderlights in Greensboro. Our first article, milepost 217.5, Cumberland Knob, a monumental drive. Black and white photo here with a suitable car, let's say, to a black and white photo of a family standing at a guardrail looking over quite an extensive valley here. In the mid-1930s, fueled by America's growing fascination with the automobile, President Franklin D. Roosevelt launched a massive program to cut a 469-mile road through the North Carolina and Virginia mountains. More than 80 years later, the Blue Ridge Parkway remains the most popular scenic byway in the country. Written by Graham Averill. On the right, a portion of the road, again in its fall foliage on both sides, going over a little bridge here. The Blue Ridge Parkway runs alongside Big Pine Creek at milepost 225 in Allegheny County. 7 miles to the south, families have stopped for the breathtaking views at Hunter's Fox Hunter's Paradise Overlook, which was the place where this family from the 1930s was looking, since at least the early 50s. Well, I guess maybe it wasn't the 30s, but the car is pretty darn old, I'll tell you that. So, into the article, just below a picture of a woman hiking by a sign that says Cumberland Knob Trail. 2-hour walk by circular trail along Gully Creek to Cumberland Knob. Cumberland Knob in return is 20 minutes in the other direction. Rebecca Moxley was 17 years old when she predicted the future. It was 1908, and Moxley, married and pregnant, had a dream that she would die shortly after giving birth. She asked a local farmer, Pack Murphy, if she could be buried beneath her favorite apple tree on his land at Cumberland Knob, just south of the Virginia border. Murphy agreed, and Moxley died 3 days after her son was born. Moxley may have predicted her own death, but she couldn't have foreseen what would have become of her final resting place. That would become an integral piece of the most ambitious scenic road project to date. That the economy would collapse, that the road, which is now called the Blue Ridge Parkway, would be way out of the depression, putting locals to work and giving generations a destination to explore. She couldn't have predicted that the automobile would become an obsession for those who could afford one, that the Patrick Murphy's farm would one day be a recreation area where a new breed of tourists would hike, rest, and picnic just feet from her grave. The world was about to change when Rebecca Moxley passed away. There were no paved roads in her rural corner of North Carolina. Most farmers still depended on horses and oxen for travel. But Ford had just introduced the Model T. And in a few short decades, the federal government would see the popularity of cars and the demand for paved roads as a way to break rural families out of poverty. The Blue Ridge Parkway would be a massive economic stimulus project that would simultaneously preserve the culture of southern Appalachia and give its people steady work. The project would take more than 50 years to complete, and it would begin in Cumberland Knob, near the spot where Rebecca Moxley was laid to rest. The Blue Ridge Parkway is a two-lane highway that runs 469 miles from the southern tip of Virginia's Shenandoah National Park to the east edge of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in North Carolina. The road follows the ridgeline of six mountain chains undulating between pastoral valleys and lofty peaks. There are no stop signs, no traffic lights, and few access roads. Dubbed America's favorite drive, the parkway was a behemoth of an undertaking and a constant presence in the young life of Carlton Abbott, whose father Stanley was the landscape architect charged with designing and constructing the national park. This wasn't just a road. It was 3 miles wide at places, the younger Abbott says. It has more border area than most countries in the world. It's large and ambitious. It was the first time anything like this was ever done. It's still one of the few parkways of its scope in the entire world. Most accounts attribute the inception of the Blue Ridge Parkway to Virginia Senator Harry Byrd. In 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt visited a Civilian Conservation Corps camp where men were working on the fledgling Skyline Drive, a 105-mile two-lane road that would cut through the heart of the new Shenandoah National Park. Roosevelt was smitten with this job-creating project, and Byrd suggested funding a larger road that would eventually connect Shenandoah with Great Smoky Mountains National Park. But the notion of a road traversing the southern Appalachians predates even the establishment of the National Park Service. In 1906, a North Carolina geologist, Joseph Hyde Pratt, proposed a scenic road through the southwestern Virginia and western North Carolina that he called the Crest of the Blue Ridge. He acquired funds and even started building the road in 1914, but construction was scrapped when the United States became involved in the First World War. By contrast, Roosevelt's road had the benefits of perfect timing. The automobile craze had taken hold of the country, and scenic drives were a newfound pastime. Meanwhile, the Great Depression had many in need of work. The first funds for the Shenandoah Great Smoky Mountains Parkway were authorized in 1933. Politicians called it the Appalachian Scenic Highway, but locals just referred to it as the Scenic. Congress renamed it the Blue Ridge Parkway in 1936, a year after construction started. Passing legislation to create the road proved easier than building the thing. The Southern Appalachians in 1935 were isolated, occupied mostly by subsistence farmers who were cut off from the rest of the country by the mountains that they called home. Paved roads were virtually non-existent and maps were scarce. To help guide the route in North Carolina, R. Getty Browning, chief location engineer for the North Carolina Highway Commission, walked the entire length of the would-be road himself, finding the optimal route for the pavement on foot. He described the landscape as an unbroken wilderness. The rugged terrain was daunting, but the largest roadblock to construction was winning the public's trust. Most locals were initially excited about the prospect of a highway connecting their farms to the rest of the world, but they were dismayed to learn that they wouldn't be allowed to build access roads to the highway or establish businesses to capitalize on the travelers. The Blue Ridge Parkway was to be a different kind of highway, a road focused on recreation, not transportation, beauty, not business. Not only would the government need a right-of-way for the road, but it would also need to purchase or condemn large swaths of land on either side to preserve the scenic quality of the area. Landscape architect Stanley Abbott insisted that a broad strip of parkland surrounding the pavement would be needed to eliminate the parasitic and unsightly border development of the hot dog stand, the gasoline shack, and the billboard. Carlton Abbott, who became an accomplished architect in his own right, eventually designed the Blue Ridge Parkway headquarters complex, says that his father was dedicated to the idea that the road would be a vehicle for preservation. He picked up on the notion that the great American countryside, which he saw was disappearing, and he thought that this road could preserve some of it, the younger Abbott says. This is one of the only national parks that derives its beauty from man's design. I think he knew how significant it would be. North Carolina and Virginia paid most landowners $30 an acre for tracts along the corridor, while some wealthier parties that could afford lawyers received more than $300 per acre. Some families sold willingly, while others were less enthusiastic. Construction proceeded in segments as land was purchased, and parkway workers reported a variety of protests along the way, from locals vandalizing construction equipment to one farmer greeting a road crew with a shotgun because he was worried that the noise from construction would disturb his chickens. Still, the majority of residents were eager for the work that the road provided. Actual construction began on September 11, 1935, when 100 men showed up to start prepping Pack Murphy's farm for the road. Skilled contractors were brought in from outside the area, but one project supervisor for the National Park Service noted that about 90% of the hand labor came from nearby creeks and coves. Those local laborers were paid 30 cents an hour and worked 6 days a week, digging stumps out of the ground, moving rocks, and eventually hand-leveling the roadbed for the parkway. The National Park Service has an archive of photographs showing men in brimmed hats, collared shirts, and overalls posing next to equipment, digging ditches and building stone walls. A few different New Deal-era alphabet soup federal agencies had a hand in the parkway's construction, with the Works Progress Administration, WPA, focusing on clearing and grading the roadbed, while the Emergency Relief Administration, ERA, and the Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, concentrated on landscaping and trail projects. A staff of landscape architects and engineers oversaw the effort, ensuring that the work had little impact on the mountains. Stanley Abbott wanted the parkway to fit into the mountains as if nature had put it there. Every aspect of the road was agonized over, down to the smallest detail, like the stonework that protected a roadside tree. All elements must compose so as to please, Abbott wrote. And before I go on, there is an old black-and-white photograph here at the top, which is kind of interesting. It says, in 1936, workers near Cumberland Knob stood amid check dams that were constructed of logs and built for erosion control along the parkway. So here we have these check dams, as they're called. There's about six horizontal logs about 6 feet long between ones that come stick out from the area behind. The whole thing's on a slope, and they're trying to stop the erosion further. So they punch these rods into the slope, and then they put these cross rods, and then they punch another block back in there. So these men in these overalls, and they're all wearing their straw hats. I'm looking up at the camera here, and they're trying to stop the erosion while they work. In many ways, the Blue Ridge Parkway was a restoration project, as decades of poor farming and logging practices had wreaked havoc on the land. The CCC worked to reforest the slopes surrounding the parkways, cutting down certain trees to open up views while planting native vegetation to restore Bear Mountain. In the spring of 1937, the CCC planted 225,000 pine seedlings that were donated by Great Smoky Mountains National Parks Nursery. Work on the parkway progressed rapidly in the early years. The first 12.5-mile segment of road and the Cumberland Knob Recreation Area opened in 1937. By the end of that year, 115 miles of the road were graded. Throughout the 1940s, Cumberland Knob was the most popular recreation area along the route. In photos from that area, families and groups picnicked in suits, dresses, and hats, sipping soft drinks out of big glass bottles. An apple tree under which Rebecca Moxley was buried is gone now, but the forest that surrounds the picnic field is healthier than it was when the National Park Service first took ownership. Picnic tables border the trees close to the parking lot, and a couple of horseshoe pits, overgrown and underused, are dug into the edge of a long meadow extending from Moxley's resting place. Walk the short Cumberland Knob Trail and you'll find the original picnic shelter. The stacked stone walls and chimney are still in good shape, but the timber beams sag with age. Carry on down the path and you can hike the Gully Creek Trail to a series of small falls that tumble over rock slabs and empty into shallow pools. The CCC built this trail and it's a work of art, meandering in and out of ravines, passing massive boulders and slopes thick with ferns. One can imagine the laborers, who are local and likely familiar with the terrain, taking pride in their work and joy in the notion that every foot of trail that they built showed off more of their spectacular backyard. The Blue Ridge Parkway might have been a public works program for those in need during the 1930s, but the true legacy of the project lies in the preservation of Southern Appalachian nooks and crannies for future generations. The gentle slope of a roadside meadow, the careful intersection of a trail crossing a creek, the shade of the trees surrounding Rebecca Moxley's grave. Those details are all part of a gift that might be even better received today, and it was first given in 1937. We're going to go back to the front part of the book and read some short articles here so that we don't have to stop in the middle of the next article. We're going to work on Welcome Home, Quick Bite, Harvest Half Moons. A self-taught baker's sweet, gooey fried peas have made her famous in Montgomery County. When Karen Saunders announced that her husband, that she was going to start hosting Pampered Chef cookware parties, he replied that there was only one problem. "You can't cook," she recalls with a laugh. But Saunders was a quick study, and she went on to have a successful 17-year career with the company before trading in that apron to focus on her own business, Karen's Fried Peas and More, full-time in 2015. Saunders began selling pastries as a part-time venture in 2005, whipping up everything from no-bake cookies to tomato quiches in her kitchen in Troy. Her dad, who owns P.R. Moore's Produce in Bisco with her mom, asked if she could make fried apple pies, a popular request with the tour bus groups that frequently stop at the old-fashioned fruit and vegetable stand. "I don't know, but I'll try," she told him. Saunders combined fried pie recipes from her husband's grandmother and her aunt Darlene and threw in a little something she learned in home economics class. She made samples, some of which ended up in the pasture out back, and took them around town for taste testing. Finally, she perfected a recipe for half-moon pies that burst with ooey, gooey goodness. Karen's Fried Pies and More, Facebook.com. And exactly that name, Karen's Fried Pies and More. Now, welcome home, handmade, Hope Mills Nature's Grace. For one Cumberland County creator, the secret to making exquisite hand-dyed garments and accessories is simple. Trust the earth's ingredients and the company of a tiny assistant. Andrea Schmidt picks fiery marigolds from her raised flower beds as her four-year-old daughter Grace drives by in a miniature John Deere tractor. This is what Schmidt calls work-life balance. Schmidt, a single mom and founder of Rise and Ramble, a small-batch, hand-dyed apparel company, loves the freedom of running her business from her Hope Mills home. Grace smiles sheepishly and buries her face in Schmidt's lap when asked if she helps her mom make clothes. She likes to help me with the fun outside stuff, stirring the dye pot and picking the flowers, Schmidt says, stroking Grace's hair. Grace returns to her tractor, and Schmidt carries the marigolds to her porch. She'll use these flowers, along with pecans from a tree in her front yard, onion skins, avocado peels, an array of herbs and teas, and anything else she can forage to create dyes for her original garments. It's amazing how many different things you can use to color something, Schmidt says. You don't always know how it's going to turn out. It's like a surprise when you unravel it. To browse Schmidt's naturally dyed clothes and accessories, visit riseandramble.com. And finally, welcome home, Shopkeep, Rocky Mount Finders Keepers. A Nash County artist with a knack for making old things new again brings together storied wood and vintage metal items to create one-of-a-kind tables. Marilyn Barner Anselmi thought that the floor joist she'd helped remove during rehab of a downtown Rocky Mount historic building in 2014 was interesting. When she cleaned it up, polyurethaned it, and attached it to a 100-year-old Singer sewing machine base, it became furniture and sold instantly. Now her pieces, all made in her studio, Red Oak Wood Shop, with found metal objects, can be seen in galleries, juried art shows, restaurants, businesses, and of course, people's homes. I accidentally created an aesthetic, she says, of a whole variety of tables she creates, which manages to be simultaneously sleek, antique, and homey, and gorgeous. If you're interested in learning more, visit the Red Oak Wood Shop at Tar River Arts Collective on 911 Falls Road in Rocky Mount. RedOakWoodShop.com. Don't you love those simple names? RedOakWoodShop.com. And that, my friends, is all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and I think you'll find us on iTunes also. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.